Is this the man who raped you?
One thing I can tell, lady, you ain't never been raped.
She looked down at the photograph briefly, then up at Sharon briefly.
It looks like him, but he wasn't laughing.
After a moment, Sharon asks, may I sit down? The girl says nothing, only sighs and folds her arms. Sharon sits beside her on the bed. There must be 2,000 transistor radios playing all around them, and all of them are playing B.B. King. Actually, Sharon cannot tell what the radios are playing, but she recognizes the beat. It has never sounded louder, more insistent, more plaintive. It has never before sounded so determined and dangerous. This beat is echoed in the many human voices and corroborated by the sea, which shines and shines beyond the garbage heap of the favela. Sharon sits and listens. Listens like she never has before. The girl's face is turned toward the window. Sharon wonders what she is hearing, what she is singing. Perhaps she is not seeing or hearing anything. She sits with a stubborn, still helplessness, her thin hands limp between her knees, like one who has been caught in traps before. Sharon watches her fragile back. The girl's curly hair is beginning to dry out and is dark at the roots. The beat of the music rises higher, becoming almost unbearable, beginning to sound inside Sharon's head and causing her to feel that her mind is about to crack. She is very close to tears now. She cannot tell herself why. She rises from the bed and walks toward the music. She looks at the children and watches the sea. In the distance there is an archway, not unlike the archway through which she has walked, abandoned by the Moors. She turns and looks at the girl. The girl is looking down at the floor.
Were you born here?
Sharon asks her.
Look, lady, before you go any further, just let me tell you, you can't do nothing to me. I ain't alone and helpless here. I got friends, just let me tell you.
And she flashes up at Sharon a furious, frightened, doubting look. But she does not move.
I'm not trying to do anything to you. I'm just trying to get a man out of jail.
The girl turns on the bed, putting her back to Sharon. An innocent man. Sharon adds,
lady, I think you in the wrong place. I really do. Ain't no reason to talk to me. Ain't nothing I can do.
Sharon begins searching. How long were you in New York? The girl flicks her cigarette out the window.
Too long.
Did you leave your children there?
Listen, leave my children out of this.
It is getting hot in the room and Sharon takes off her light cloth jacket and sits down again on the bed. She says carefully, am a mother too. The girl looks at her, attempting a scornful distance. But though she and envy are familiars, scorn is unknown to her.
Why did you come back here?
Sharon asks her. This is not the question which the girl had expected. In fact, it is not the question which Sharon had intended to ask. And they look at each other, the questions shimmering between them the way the light changes on the sea.
You said you're a mother,
the girl says finally, and rises and walks again to the window. This time Sharon follows her and they stare out at the sea together. In a way, with the girl's sullen answer, Sharon's mind begins to clear. In the girl's answer, she reads a plea. She begins to speak to her differently.
Daughter,
in this world, terrible things happen to you. And we can all do some terrible things. She is carefully looking out of the window. She is watching the girl. I was a woman before you got to be a woman. Remember that. But, and she turns to Victoria. She pulls the girl toward her. The thin wrists, the bony hands, the folded arms, touching her, lightly. She tries to speak as though she were speaking to me.
You pay for the lies you tell.
She stares at the girl. The girl stares at her.
You've put a man in jail, daughter. A man you've never seen. He's 22 years old, daughter. He wants to marry my daughter. And
Victoria's eyes meet hers again.
He's black.
She lets the girl go and turns back to the window.
Like us.
I did see him.
You saw him in the police lineup. That's the first time you saw him, and the only time. What made you so sure?
Because I've known him all his life.
Ha! Says Victoria, and tries to move away.
Tears rise in the dark, defeated eyes.
If you knew how many women I've heard say that, they didn't see him when I saw him, when he came to me. They never see that. Respectable women like you, they never see that.
The tears begin to roll down her face.
You might have known a nice little boy, and he might be a nice man with you, but you don't know the man who did what he did to me.
But are you, Sharon asks, sure that you know him?
Yes, I'm sure. They took me down there and they asked me to pick him out, and I picked him out. That's all.
But you were. It happened in the dark. You saw Alonzo Hunt in the lights.
There's lights in the hallway. I saw enough.
Sharon grabs her again and touches the crucifix.
Daughter, daughter, in the name of God.
Victoria looks down at the hand on the cross and screams. A sound like no sound Sharon has ever heard before. She breaks away from Sharon and runs to the door, which has remained open all this time. She is screaming and crying,
"Get out of here! Get out of here!"
Doors open. People begin to appear. Sharon hears the taxi horn. 1, 2, 1, 2, 1, 2, 3. 1, 2, 3. Victoria is now screaming in Spanish. One of the older women in the hall comes to the door and takes Victoria in her arms. Victoria collapses, weeping, into this woman's breasts, and the woman, without a look at Sharon, leads her away. But everyone else gathering is staring at Sharon. And now the lonely sound Sharon hears is the horn of Jaime's taxi. They are staring at her clothes. There is nothing she can say to them. She moves into the hallway toward them. Her light summer jacket is over her arm. She is holding her handbag. She has the photograph of Fanny and me in one hand. She gets past them slowly and slowly gets down the staring stairs. There are people on every landing. She gets out of the courtyard into the street. Jaime opens the taxi door for her. She gets in. He slams the door, and without a word, he drives her away. In the evening, she goes to the club, but the doorman informs her Señor Alvarez will not be there this evening, that there are no tables for single women, and that anyway, the club is full. The mind is like an object that picks up dust. The object doesn't know, any more than the mind does, why what clings to it clings. But once whatever it is lights on you, it doesn't go away. And so, after that afternoon at the vegetable stand, I saw Belle everywhere and all the time. I did not know his name then. I discovered his name on the night I asked him for it. I had already memorized his badge number. I had certainly seen him before that particular afternoon, but he had been just another cop. After that afternoon, he had red hair and blue eyes. He was somewhere in his 30s. He walked the way John Wayne walks, striding out to clean up the universe, and he believed all that shit. A wicked, stupid, infantile motherfucker. Like his heroes, he was kind of pinheaded, heavy-gutted, big-assed, and his eyes were as blank as George Washington's eyes. But I was beginning to learn something about the blankness of those eyes. What I was learning was beginning to frighten me to death. If you look steadily into that unblinking blue, into that pinpoint at the center of the eye, you discover a bottomless cruelty, a viciousness cold and icy. In that eye, you do not exist. If you are lucky, if that eye, from its height, has been forced to notice you, if you do exist in the unbelievably frozen winter which lives behind that eye, you are marked, 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 like a man in a black overcoat, crawling, fleeing across the snow. The eye resents your presence in the landscape, cluttering up the view. Presently, the black overcoat will be still, turning red with blood, and the snow will be red, and the eye resents this too, blinks once, and causes more snow to fall, covering it all. Sometimes I was with Fonny when I crossed Belle's path. Sometimes I was alone. When I was with Fonny, the eyes looked straight ahead into a freezing sun. When I was alone, the eyes clawed me like a cat's claws, raked me like a rake. These eyes look only into the eyes of the conquered victim. They cannot look into any other eyes. When Fonny was alone, the same thing happened. Belle's eyes swept over Fonny's black body with the unanswerable cruelty of lust, as though he had lit the blowtorch and had it aimed at Fonny's sex. When their paths crossed, and I was there, Fonny looked straight at Belle. Belle looked straight ahead. "I'm gonna fuck you, boy," Belle's eyes said. "No, you won't," said Fonny's eyes. "I'm gonna get my shit together and haul ass out of here." I was frightened because in the streets of the village, I realized that we were entirely alone. Nobody cared about us except us, or whoever loved us was not there. Belle spoke to me once. I was making it to Fonny's, late, from work. I was surprised to see him because I had got off the subway at 14th Street and 8th Avenue, and he was usually in the neighborhood of Bleecker and McDougal. I was huffing and puffing down the avenue, carrying a package of odds and ends I had lifted from the Jew, when I saw him walking slowly up the avenue toward me. For a minute, I was frightened because my package, which had things like glue and staples and watercolors and paper and tacks and nails and pins, was hot.
But he couldn't know that. And I already hated him too much to care. I walked toward him. He walked toward me. It was beginning to be dark around 7:30. The streets were full. Homeward men, leaning drunkards, fleeing women, Puerto Rican kids, junkies. Here came Bell. Can I carry that for you? I almost dropped it. In fact, I almost peed on myself. I looked into his eyes. No, I said. Thanks very much. And I tried to keep moving, but he was standing in my way. I looked into his eyes again. This may have been the very first time I ever really looked into a white man's eyes. It stopped me. I stood still. It was not like looking into a man's eyes. It was like nothing I knew. And therefore, it was very powerful. It was seduction, which contained the promise of rape. It was rape which promised debasement and revenge on both sides. I wanted to get close to him, to enter into him, to open up that face and change it and destroy it, descend into the slime with him. Then we would both be free. I could almost hear the singing.
Well, he said in a very low voice. You ain't got far to go. Sure wish I could carry it for you, though.
I can still see us on that hurrying, crowded Twilight Avenue, me with my package and my handbag, staring at him, he staring at me. I was suddenly his. A desolation entered me which I had never felt before. I watched his eyes. His moist, boyish, despairing lips, and felt his sex stiffening against me.
I ain't a bad guy, he said. Tell your friend. You ain't gotta be afraid of me.
I'm not afraid, I said. I'll tell him. Thanks.
Good night, he said.
Good night. I answered, and I hurried on my way. I never told Fonny about it. I couldn't. I blotted it out of my mind. I don't know if Belle ever spoke to Fonny. I doubt it. On the night that Fonny was arrested, Daniel was at the house. He was a little drunk. He was crying. He was talking again about his time in prison. He had seen 9 men rape 1 boy, and he had been raped. He would never, never, never again be the Daniel he had been. Fonny held him up just before he fell. I went to make the coffee. And then they came knocking at the door. 2. Zion. Fonny is working on the wood. It is a soft brown wood. It stands on his work table. He has decided to do a bust of me. The wall is covered with sketches. I am not there. His tools are on the table. He walks around the wood, terrified. He does not want to touch it. He knows that he must, but he does not want to defile the wood. He stares and stares, almost weeping. He wishes that the wood would speak to him. He is waiting for the wood to speak. Until it speaks, he cannot move. I am imprisoned somewhere in the silence of that wood, and so is he. He picks up a chisel, he puts it down. He lights a cigarette, sits down on his work stool, stares, picks up the chisel again. He puts it down, goes into the kitchen to pour himself a beer, comes back with the beer, sits down on the stool again, stares at the wood. The wood stares back at him.
You cunt, says Fonny. He picks up the chisel again and approaches the waiting wood. He touches it very lightly with his hand. He caresses it. He listens. He puts the chisel teasingly against it. The chisel begins to move. Fonny begins and wakes up. He is in a cell by himself at the top of the prison. This is provisional. Soon, he will be sent downstairs to a larger cell with other men. There is a toilet in the corner of the cell. It stinks. And Fonny stinks. He yawns, throwing his arms behind his head, and turns furiously on the narrow cot. He listens. He cannot tell what time it is, but it does not matter. The hours are all the same. The days are all the same. He looks at his shoes, which have no laces, on the floor beside the cot. He tries to give himself some reason for being here, some reason to move or not to move. He knows that he must do something to keep himself from drowning in this place, and every day he tries, but he does not succeed. He can neither retreat into himself nor step out of himself. He is righteously suspended. He is still. He is still with fear. He rises and walks to the corner and pees. The toilet does not work very well. Soon it will overflow. He does not know what he can do about it. He is afraid up here alone. But he is also afraid of the moment when he will be moved downstairs with the others, whom he sees at meal times, who see him. He knows who they are. He has seen them all before. Were they to encounter each other outside, he would know what to say to them. Here he knows nothing. He is dumb. He is absolutely terrified. Here he is at everyone's mercy. And he is also at the mercy of this stone and steel. Outside, he is not young. Here he realizes that he is young, very young, too young. And will he grow old here? He stares through the small opening in the cell door into what he can see of the corridor. Everything is still and silent. It must be very early. He wonders if today is the day he will be taken to the showers, but he does not know what day it is. He cannot remember how long ago it was that he was taken to the showers. I'll ask somebody today, he thinks, and then I'll remember. I've got to make myself remember. I can't let myself go like this. He tries to remember everything he has ever read about life in prison. He can remember nothing. His mind is as empty as a shell, rings like a shell with a meaningless sound. No questions, no answers, nothing. And he stinks. He yawns again. He scratches himself. He shivers. With a mighty effort, he stifles a scream, grabs the bars of the high window and looks up into what he can see of the sky. The touch of the steel calms him a little. The cool, rough stone against his skin comforts him a little. He thinks of Frank, his father. He thinks of me. He wonders what we are doing now at this very moment. He wonders what the whole world, his world, is doing without him. Why he has been left alone here, perhaps to die. The sky is the color of the steel. The heavy tears drip down Fonny's face, causing the stubble on his face to itch. He cannot muster his defenses because he can give himself no reason for being here. He lies back down on the cot. He has 5 cigarettes left. He knows that I will bring him cigarettes this evening. He lights a cigarette, staring up at the pipes on the ceiling. He shakes. He tries to put his mind at ease. Just one more day. Don't sweat it. Be cool. He drags on the cigarette. His prick hardens. Absently, he strokes it through his shorts. It is his only friend. He clenches his teeth and resists. But he is young, and he is lonely. He is alone. He strokes himself gently as though in prayer, closing his eyes. His rigid sex responds, burning. And Fani sighs, dragging on the cigarette again. He pauses, but his hand will not be still. Cannot be still. He catches his lower lip in his teeth, wishing, but the hand will not be still. He lifts himself out of his shorts and pulls the blanket up to his chin. The hand will not be still. It tightens. It tightens, moving faster. And Fani sinks and rises. Oh. He tries to think of no one. He tries not to think of me. He does not wish me to have any connection with this cell or with this act. Oh. And he turns, rising, writhing, his belly beginning to shake. Oh. And great tears gather behind his eyes. He does not want it to end. It must end. Oh. 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 He drops his cigarette on the stone floor. He surrenders totally. He pretends that human arms are holding him. He moans. He nearly screams. His thickening, burning sex causes him to arch his back and his limbs stiffen. Oh, he does not want it to end. It must end. He moans. It is unbelievable. His sex trickles, spurts, explodes all over his hand and his belly and his balls. He sighs. After a long moment, he opens his eyes, and the cell comes crashing down on him, steel and stone, making him know he is alone. He is brought down to see me at 6 o'clock. He remembers to pick up the phone. Hey! And he grins. How you doing, baby? Tell me something. You know I ain't got nothing to tell. How you? He kisses the glass. I kiss the glass. But he does not look well. Hayward's coming to see you tomorrow morning. He thinks he's got a date fixed for the trial.
For when?
Soon. Very soon.
What do you mean by soon? Tomorrow? Next month? Next year?
Would I tell you, Fani, if I didn't know it was soon? Would I? And Hayward told me I could tell you.
Before the baby gets here?
Oh, yes. Before the baby gets here.
When is it due?
Soon. His face changes then and he laughs. He makes a mock menacing gesture with one fist.
How is it, the baby?
Alive and kicking, believe me.
Whipping your ass, huh? He laughs again. Oh, Tish.
And again his face changes. Another light comes into it. He is very beautiful.
You seen Frank?
Yes. He's been doing a lot of overtime. He'll be here tomorrow.
He coming with you?
No. He's coming with Hayward in the morning.
How is he?
He's fine, baby.
And my two funky sisters? They're like they've always been. Not married yet?
No, Fani, not yet. I wait for the next question.
And my mama? I haven't seen her, naturally. But she seems to be all right.
A weak heart ain't done her in yet, huh? Your mama back from Puerto Rico?
Not yet, but we expect her any minute. His face changes again.
But if that chick still says I raped her, I'm gonna be here for a while.
I light a cigarette. And I put it out. The baby moves as though it is trying to get a glimpse of Fonny. Mama thinks that Hayward can destroy her testimony. She seems to be a kind of hysterical woman. She's a part-time whore anyway. That doesn't help her case. And you were the blackest thing in the lineup that morning. There were some white cats and a Puerto Rican and a couple of light brown brothers, but you were the only black man.
I don't know how much that's going to mean.
Well, one thing it can mean is that the case can be thrown out of court. She says she was raped by a black man, and so they put one black man in a lineup with a whole lot of pale dudes. And so naturally she says it was you. If she was looking for a black cat, she knows it can't be none of the others.
What about Bill?
Well, he's already killed one black kid, just like I told you, and Hayward will make sure that the jury knows that.
Shit. If the jury knows that, they'll probably want to give him a medal. He's keeping the streets safe.
Fonny, don't think like that, baby. We agreed when this shit started that we'd just have to move it from day to day and not blow our cool and not try to think too far ahead. I know exactly what you mean, sweetheart, but there's no point in thinking about it like that.
Do you miss me?
Oh, God, yes. That's why you can't blow your cool. I'm waiting for you. The baby's waiting for you.
I'm sorry, Tish. I'm sorry. I'll get it together. I really will. But sometimes it's hard. 'Cause I ain't got no business here, you know? And things are happening inside me that I don't really understand. Like I'm beginning to see things I never saw before. I don't have any words for those things, and I'm scared. I'm not as tough as I thought I was. I'm younger than I thought I was. But I'll get it together, I promise you. I promise, Tish. I'll be better when I come out than I was when I came in. I promise. I know it, Tish. Maybe there's something I had to see, and I couldn't have seen it without coming in here. Maybe. Maybe that's it. Oh, Tish, do you love me?
I love you. I love you. You have to know I love you. Just like you know that nappy hair is growing on your head.
Do I look awful?
Well, I wish I could get my hands on you, but you're beautiful to me.
I wish I could get my hands on you, too.
A silence falls, and we look at each other. We are looking at each other when the door opens behind Fonny and the man appears. This is always the most awful moment. When Fonny has to rise and turn, I have to rise and turn. But Fonny is cool. He stands and raises his fist. He smiles and stands there for a moment, looking me dead in the eye. Something travels from him to me. It is love and courage. Yes. Yes, we are going to make it, somehow. Somehow. I stand and smile and raise my fist. He turns into the inferno. I walk toward the Sahara. The miscalculations of this world are vast. The DA's office, the prosecution, the state, the people versus Alonzo Hunt has managed to immobilize, isolate, or intimidate
every witness for Alonzo Hunt. But it has fucked itself up, too, as a thinned Sharon informs us on the night that Ernestine borrows the actress's car and chauffeur to bring Mama home from Kennedy Airport. I waited for another 2 days. I thought, it can't go down like that. The deal cannot go down like that. Jaime said that it would go down like that. By this time, the story was all over the island. Everybody knew it. Jaime knew more about it than I knew myself. He said that I was being followed everywhere, that we were being followed everywhere. And one night in the taxi, he proved it. I'll tell you about that another day. Mama's face. She, too, is seeing something she never saw before. I couldn't go around anymore. For the last 2 days, Jaime got to be my spy, really. They knew his taxi better than they knew him, if you see what I mean. People always know the outside better than they know the inside. If they saw Jaime's taxi coming, well, that was Jaime. They didn't look inside. Sharon's face. And Joseph's face. So, he borrowed somebody else's car. That way they didn't see him coming. By the time they did see him, it didn't make any difference, since he wasn't with me. He was part of the landscape, like the sea. Like the garbage heap, he was something they had known all their lives. They didn't have to look at him. I had never seen it like that before. Maybe they didn't dare look at him. Like they don't look at the garbage dump. Like they don't look at themselves, like we don't look. I had never seen it like that before, never. I don't speak no Spanish and they don't speak no English, but we on the same garbage dump, for the same reason. She looks at me. For the same reason. I had never thought about it like that before. Whoever discovered America deserved to be dragged home in chains to die. She looks at me again. You get that baby here. You hear me? And she smiles. She smiles. She is very close to me. And she is very far away. We ain't gonna let nobody put chains on that baby. That's all. She rises and paces the kitchen. We watch her. She has lost weight. She holds a gin and orange juice in her hand. I know that she has not yet unpacked. I realize because I watch her fighting her tears that she is really, after all, young. Anyway, he was there. Jaime was there. When they carried the chick away, she was screaming. She was having a miscarriage. Pietro carried her down the steps in his arms. She had already started to bleed. She sips her drink. She stands at our window, very much alone. She was carried to the mountains, someplace called Barranquitas. You got to know where it is to get there. Jaime says that she will never be seen again. There goes the trial. The prosecution having fucked itself out of its principal witness. We have a slim hope still in Daniel, but not one of us can see him, even if we knew where he could be found. He has been transferred to a prison upstate. Hayward is checking it out. Hayward is on the case. The prosecution will ask for time. We will ask that the charge be dropped and the case dismissed. But must be prepared to settle for bail, if the state will concede it, if we can raise it.
All right, says Joseph, stands, walks to the window, stands next to Sharon but does not touch her.
They watch their island.
You okay?
Asks Joseph and lights a cigarette and hands it to her.
Yeah. I'm okay.
Then let's go on in. You're tired and you've been gone a while.
Good night, says Ernestine firmly. And Sharon and Joseph, their arms around each other, walk down the hall to their room. In a way, we are their elders now. And the baby kicks again. Time. But the effect of all this on Frank is cataclysmic, is absolutely disastrous, and it is Joseph who has to bring him the news. Their hours are, furthermore, now so erratic that he has to bring the news to the house. Without a word, he has managed to forbid both Ernestine and myself from saying a word to the Hunts. It is about midnight. Mrs. Hunt is in bed. Adrienne and Sheila have just come in and, standing in the kitchen in their nightgowns, are giggling and sipping Ovaltine. Adrienne's behind is spreading, but there is no hope for Sheila at all. Sheila has been told that she resembles a nothing actress, Merle Oberon, whom she has encountered on the Late Late Show, and so she has clipped her eyebrows with the same intention, but not to the same effect. The Oberon chick was paid, at least, for her disquieting resemblance to an egg. Joseph must be on the docks in the early morning, and so he has no time to waste. Neither does Frank, who must also be downtown early. Frank puts a beer before Joseph, pours a little wine for himself. Joseph takes a sip of his beer. Frank sips his wine. They watch each other for a rather awful moment, aware of the girl's laughter in the kitchen. Frank wants to make the laughter stop, but he cannot take his eyes from Joseph's eyes.
Well, says Frank, brace yourself. I'm going to hit you hard. The trial's been postponed because the Puerto Rican chick, Dig, has lost her baby and looked like she's flipped her wig, too. Lost her mind, man. Anyway, she's in the hills of Puerto Rico someplace and she can't be moved and can't nobody see her. She can't come to New York now, no way. And so the city wants the trial postponed until she can.
Frank says nothing. Joseph says,
you understand what I'm saying?
Frank sips his wine and says quietly,
yeah, I understand.
They hear the girls' low voices in the kitchen. This sound is about to drive both men insane. Frank says,
you telling me that they gonna keep Fonny in jail until this chick comes to her senses?
He sips his wine again, looks at Joseph.
Is that right?
Something in Frank's aspect is beginning to terrify Joseph, but he does not know what it is.
Well, that's what they want to do, but we might be able to get him out on bail.
Frank says nothing. The girls giggle in the kitchen.
How much bail? We don't know. It ain't been set yet.
He sips his beer, more and more frightened, obscurely but profoundly.
When is it going to be set? Tomorrow, the day after.
He has to say it.
If what? If they accept our plea, man, they ain't got to let us have no bail.
There's something else he has to say.
And I don't think this will happen, but it's better to look at it from the worst side. They might try to make the charge against Fonny heavier because the chick's lost her baby and seems to have flipped her wig.
Silence. The girlish laughter from the kitchen. Joseph scratches one armpit, watching Frank. Joseph is more and more uneasy.
So, says Frank, finally, with an icy tranquility, we're fucked.
What makes you say that, man? It's rough, I agree, but it ain't yet over.
Oh, yes, says Frank, it's over. They got him. They ain't gonna let him go till they get ready. And they ain't ready yet, and ain't nothing we can do about it.
Joseph shouts out of his fear.
We got to do something about it.
He hears his voice banging against the walls, against the girlish laughter from the kitchen.
What can we do about it? If they give us bail, get the change together. How? Man, I don't know how. I just know we have to do it.
And if they don't give us bail?
We get him out. I don't care what we have to do to get him out.
I don't neither. But what can we do?
Get him out. That's what we have to do. We both know he ain't got no business in there. Them lying motherfuckers, they know it too.
He stands. He is trembling. The kitchen is silent.
Look, I know what you're saying. You're saying they got us by the balls. Okay. But that's our flesh and blood, baby. Our flesh and blood. I don't know how we gonna do it. I just know we have to do it. I know you ain't scared for you, and God knows I ain't scared for me. That boy is got to come out of there. That's all. And we got to get him out. That's all. And the first thing we got to do, man, is just not to lose our nerve. We can't let these cunt-faced, white-ass motherfuckers get away with this shit no longer.
He subsides. He sips his beer.
They've been killing our children long enough.
Frank looks toward the open kitchen door where his two daughters stand.
Is everything all right? Adrienne asks.
Frank hurls his glass of wine onto the floor. It rings and shatters.
You two dizzy off-white cunts, get the fuck out of my face, you hear? Get the fuck out of my face! If you was any kind of women, you'd be peddling pussy on the block to get your brother out of jail instead of giving it away for free to all them half-ass faggots who come sniffing around you with a book under their arm. Go to bed! Get out of my face!
Joseph watches the daughters. He sees something very strange, something he had never thought of. He sees that Adrienne loves her father with a really desperate love. She knows he is in pain. She would soothe it if she could. She does not know how. She would give anything to know how. She does not know that she reminds Frank of her mother. Without a word, she drops her eyes and turns away, and Sheila follows her. The silence is enormous. It spreads and spreads. Frank puts his head in his hands. Then Joseph sees that Frank loves his daughters. Frank says nothing. Tears drop onto the table, trickling down from the palms with which he has covered his face. Joseph watches. The tears drip from the palm onto the wrist bone to splash with a light, light, intolerable sound on the table. Joseph does not know what to say yet.
This ain't no time for crying, man, he says.
He finishes his beer. He watches Frank.
You all right?
Frank says finally,
yeah, I'm all right.
Joseph says,
get some sleep. We got to move it early in the morning. I'll talk to you end of the day. You got it?
Yeah, says Frank. I got it.
When Fonny learns that the trial has been postponed, and learns why,
and what effect Victoria's disaster may have on his own, it is I who tell him. Something quite strange, altogether wonderful, happens in him. It is not that he gives up hope, but that he ceases clinging to it.
Okay,
is all he says. I seem to see his high cheekbones for the first time, and perhaps this is really true. He has lost so much weight. He looks straight at me, into me. His eyes are enormous, deep, and dark. I am both relieved and frightened. He has moved, not away from me, but he has moved. He is standing in a place where I am not. And he asks me, staring at me with those charged, enormous eyes,
"You all right?"
"Yes, I'm all right."
"The baby all right?"
"Yes, the baby's fine." He grins. It is somehow a shock. I will always see the space where the missing tooth has been.
"Well, I'm all right, too. Don't you worry, I'm coming home. I'm coming home to you. I want you in my arms. I want your arms around me. I've got to hold our baby in my arms. It's got to be. You keep the faith."
He grins again, and everything inside me moves. Oh, love. Love.
"Don't you worry. I'll be home."
He grins again and stands and salutes me. He looks at me hard, with a look I have never seen on any face before. He touches himself briefly. He bends to kiss the glass. I kiss the glass. Now, Fonny knows why he is here, why he is where he is. Now he dares to look around him. He is not here for anything he has done. He has always known that, but now he knows it with a difference. At meals, in the showers, up and down the stairs, in the evening, just before everyone is locked in again, he looks at the others. He listens. What have they done? Not much. To do much is to have the power to place these people where they are and keep them where they are. These captive men are the hidden price for a hidden lie. The righteous must be able to locate the damned. To do much is to have the power and the necessity to dictate to the damned. But that, thinks Fonny, works both ways. You're in or you're out.
Okay, I see. Motherfuckers, you won't hang me.
I bring him books, and he reads. We manage to get him paper, and he sketches. Now that he knows where he is, he begins to talk to the men, making himself, so to speak, at home. He knows that anything may happen to him here. But since he knows it, he can no longer turn his back. He has to face it, even taunt it, play with it, dare. He is placed in solitary for refusing to be raped. He loses a tooth again and almost loses an eye. Something hardens in him. Something changes forever. His tears freeze in his belly. But he has leaped from the promontory of despair. He is fighting for his life. He sees his baby's face before him. He has an appointment he must keep, and he will be here. He swears it, sitting in the shit, sweating and stinking. When the baby gets here, Hayward arranges the possibility of bail for Fonny. But it is high. And here comes the summer. Time. On a day that I will never forget,
Pedrocito drove me home from the Spanish restaurant. And heavy, 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 I got to my chair and I sat down. The baby was restless and I was scared. It was almost time. I was so tired I almost wanted to die. For a long time, because he was in solitary, I had not been able to see Fonny. I had seen him on this day. He was so skinny. He was so bruised. I almost cried out. To whom? Where? I saw this question in Fonny's enormous, slanted, black eyes. Eyes that burned now like the eyes of a prophet. Yet, when he grinned, I saw all over again, my lover, as though for the first time. "We got to get some meat on your bones," I said. "Lord have mercy."
"Speak up, he can't hear you."
But he said it with a smile. "We almost got the money to bail you out."
"I figured you would."
We sat and we just looked at each other. We were making love to each other through all that glass and stone and steel.
"Listen, I'll soon be out. I'm coming home because I'm glad I came. Can you dig that?"
I watched his eyes. "Yes," I said.
"Now, I'm an artisan," he said, "like a cat who makes tables. I don't like the word artist. Maybe I never did. I sure the fuck don't know what it means. I'm a cat who works from his balls with his hand. I know what it's about now. I think I really do. Even if I go under, but I don't think I will. Now."
He is very far from me. He is with me, but he is very far away. And now, he always will be. "Where you lead me," I said, "I'll follow." He laughed.
"Baby, baby, baby, I love you. And I'm gonna build us a table, and a whole lot of folks gonna be eating off it for a long, long time to come."
From my chair, I looked out my window over these dreadful streets. The baby asked, "Is there not one righteous among them?" And kicked, but with a tremendous difference, and I knew that my time was almost on me. I remember that I looked at my watch. It was 7:40. I was alone, but I knew that someone soon would be coming through the door. The baby kicked again, and I caught my breath, and I almost cried. And the phone rang. I crossed the room, heavy, 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 and I picked it up. "Hello? Hello, Tish? This is Adrienne." "How are you, Adrienne?" "Tish? Have you seen my father? Is Frank there?" Her voice almost knocked me down. I had never heard such terror. "No. Why?" "When did you see him last?" "Why, I haven't seen him. I know he's seen Joseph, but I haven't seen him." Adrienne was weeping. It sounded horrible over the phone. "Adrienne, what's the matter? What's the matter?" And I remember that at that moment, everything stood still. The sun didn't move, and the earth didn't move. The sky stared down, waiting. And I put my hand on my heart to make it start beating again. "Adrienne? Adrienne?"
"Tish, my daddy was fired from his job 2 days ago. They said he was stealing, and they threatened to put him in jail, and he was all upset because of Bonnie and all. And he was drunk when he came home, and he cursed everybody out, and then he went